the built environment is really a very core sector to tackle, and it's tough. New construction is a lot easier, right? You can build to new standards, and you can be thoughtful about the energy efficiency of those new construction. But when you're looking at retrofits, there's a real investment decision to be made. And I think that it has been a challenge for some building owners and has been obviously preventing some of the large scale energy efficiency upgrades that were needed to kind of offset those emissions. But as Mitch noted, these incentives and credits are really providing a lot of runway for portfolio owners to address these things. And then to the point about, you know, new investment.
The U.S. just took its biggest leap ever in terms of energy efficiency and the climate change fight. Signed into law last month, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 contains unprecedented incentives and spending aimed at speeding the transition to clean energy, shrinking carbon emissions, and creating a clean energy economy. I'm CPE Executive Editor Therese Fitzgerald. Welcome back to Sustainability Street, our podcast on the intersection of commercial real estate and the world we live in. In this episode, I delve into what this groundbreaking act means for commercial real estate. To help me, I reached out to Josephine Tucker, Managing Director, Head of Clean Energy and Infrastructure for JLL, and Mitch Worden, Vice President, Clean Energy and Infrastructure, JLL. Let's get started. Hi, Josephine and Mitch. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. Very excited to be here today.
Before we get into the specifics of the Inflation Reduction Act and what it means for real estate, I want to talk about its significance for the country. What makes this law so historic? And Josephine, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Teresa, as a leader in the clean energy and infrastructure advisory business, obviously we were very excited to see the passage of the IRA. But more broadly, I think after decades of advocacy, you know, scientists and individuals close to this industry have been watching the ebb and flow of policy and all the while, you know, worsening of climate impacts. And so to see the passage of this law, it's really one of the most aggressive and transformative stances taken by the U.S. government and has a ton of investment opportunities that will really catalyze all sorts of industry from the very, you know, most nascent to some mature industries that I think, you know, needed some help kind of nudging things along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to just add on to that, I echo those comments by Josephine. And just to add, this IRA bill is just really the most meaningful climate bill that's ever been passed in the United States history. So, you know, from that perspective, it's really illustrating that the United States is ready to walk the walk when it comes to being a leader for the energy revolution on a global stage. And I think it really puts a flag firmly in the ground to illustrate our commitment to supporting the renewable energy industry specifically that's growing rapidly, creating jobs and innovating to solve the world's biggest problems.
It's really exciting. And yet President Biden pledged that the U.S. would reduce its emissions to 50% of pre-2005 levels by 2030. And I think this would bring us to around 40% of pre-2005 levels. So is it fair to say the new law falls short?
That's a great question. And I think one of the things to kind of frame it would be that while Biden did pledge to reduce it by 50% in pre-2005 levels, you know, where we would be without this bill, I think is important to understand because we would be on course to reach only 26%. And so while this gets us to 40, which is, you know, short of that 50%, it still advances us down the path materially to where we would have been without it. So I think, you know, when we put it in that context, it really accelerates our current trajectory and is establishing the funding that will facilitate, you know, the free market to develop innovative solutions that will make up that 10% difference between the pledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing that I would just add on to that is, you know, the difference in that 10% or what that means in a half a percent warming overall is very significant in terms of the environmental implications of that. So while, you know, we may not get fully to the 40% reduction, being a lot further along than 26 is certainly going to mean, you know, step changes of difference for a lot of places around the globe.
I've spoken about in previous episodes how the landscape of climate-related regulations and initiatives vary immensely by state and by city. Do you think this provides the national leadership on the climate change front that's been missing? And should we expect to see more jurisdictions joining in the climate fight?
Absolutely. I think it really does provide national leadership. And I think in order for the United States to be effective in creating change and moving towards a net zero future, we need both a top-down and a bottoms-up approach. And really what the Inflation Reduction Act serves is that top-down approach that will essentially enable and accelerate the disparate bottoms-up approaches that are going to be taken via different jurisdictions. When it comes to these local jurisdictions and different states, right, essentially each state can be its own market to a degree. And there's competing priorities and trade-offs that occur in those jurisdictions and at a state level. So what this top-down leadership will do via the IRA is sort of align those incentives and allow jurisdictions to sort of reprioritize that I think will then encourage more jurisdictions to get on to this climate-saving bandwagon that you mentioned.
By design, this law contains a lot more carrots than sticks. How effective do you think that approach will be?
I think policy in general has a role to play that should be a combination of carrot and stick. I'm a real advocate of a portfolio approach when it comes to those two things. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, the U.S. And many economies globally were sort of staring down the barrel of a potential recession. And so that's kind of the backdrop to, you know, this bill getting passed. And the benefit of a carrot heavy approach here is that they're catalyzing investment, they're, you know, creating kind of economic anchors in certain industries. There's a huge focus on jobs. And I think all of that is really critical at a time where there was some concern about, you know, where the economy is going. At the same time, we're getting the benefits of, you know, as we mentioned, the technology innovation, and all of that will kind of hopefully be a rising tide that lifts boats in a number of different sectors. But don't forget, there's a series of regulatory actions that are also happening unrelated to this bill. For example, you know, you've got the SEC review of climate-related disclosures. I mean, that really ties environmental impact to financial risk and will be a significant needle mover for corporates. So it's not like there aren't other things on the forefront that will be more of a stick, so to speak.
Right. And on the city level, we're starting to see more of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you want to add to that, Mitch?
Yeah, of course. Happy to. I think just kind of adding to that city level, right? Cities and what you see in more progressive states like California and New York and some of the bills and regulations that they're putting in place from a stick perspective in terms of energy efficiency requirements, renewables on buildings and housing moving forward, and the electric vehicle requirements and phasing out combustion engines. Those are all sort of sticks that will, I think, reverberate and trickle down to other jurisdictions, kind of relating this question to the question earlier about other jurisdictions moving forward. So I think I agree with Josephine on we like to see a carrot heavy component, but the sticks that are related to this will also play a role moving forward on a jurisdiction and city level.
So now let's talk about the commercial real estate implications of the law.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that the Inflation Reduction Act impacts real estate and sort of large corporate users, I think, comes down to sort of three major buckets. It's going to impact real estate from a renewable energy perspective and corporates from an on-site and an off-site perspective. And I'll dive into these as we go forward. But second would be sort of the energy efficiency measures that are really sprinkled throughout the bill. And then third would be real estate transactions in general and how the onshoring of manufacturing is going to spur real estate transactions. And so to dive into each one of those buckets a little bit more specifically and in more detail, from an on and offsite perspective, the PTC and ITC energy credit extensions are really going to spur onsite and offsite development. You know, these tax credits and the ability for real estate owners to receive them are going to allow for a 10-year runway to make these investments in their properties, as well as corporates to purchase renewables to reduce their Scope 2 emissions. Then transitioning into how is this going to impact the built environment from a building perspective and an energy efficiency perspective, I think at a high level, these tax credits are expected to really be a catalyst for building owners and developers to make energy efficiency improvements to speed up the decarbonization of their commercial real estate portfolios. You know, there's expansions of deductions that essentially, you know, to put into context, if you had a 250,000 square foot building, what was a 470,000 deduction in 2022 will now potentially increase to 1.2 million. So there's a material increase in the deductions and the benefits for pulling forward or moving forward energy efficiency measures within your building and your real estate portfolios. So I think you're just going to see a lot more retrofitting of properties and working around an existing infrastructure to really see owners making those commitments to those renovations. And then the last point, and I'll tie this up pretty quickly, is just with the goal of onshoring a lot of renewable energy manufacturing and the tax credits that were related to manufacturers for solar and wind components, that's going to spur real estate from a need of, you know, square footage manufacturing facilities, as well as just, you know, land purchasing as well throughout the country. So I think real estate will, and our industry in general, will see a benefit and a big tailwind related to the need for additional manufacturing capacity.
And one thing I just add to that, we maybe should have said this at the beginning, the macro lens on all of this is that the real estate sector represents, you know, 40% of global emissions. And so there's really no scenario in which we don't have a serious role to play in the actions to prevent climate-related impacts, right? So the built environment is really a very core sector to tackle, and it's tough. New construction is a lot easier, right? So you can build to new standards and you can be thoughtful about the energy efficiency of those new construction. But when you're looking at retrofits, there's a real investment decision to be made. And I think that it has been a challenge for some building owners and has been obviously preventing some of the large scale energy efficiency upgrades that were needed to kind of offset those emissions. But as Mitch noted, these incentives and credits are really providing a lot of runway for portfolio owners to address these things. And then to the point about, you know, new investment and what this could mean on his sort of third point there, we're already seeing a ton of large scale renewable projects that are being explored. And a lot of the real estate industry in the US, there's a lot of asset owners who are looking for ways to monetize their property and are getting very creative about some of those large scale investments like solar and wind farms and things like that. So really an exciting time for the real estate industry. And I think finally getting that support that's really needed to be a serious partner in the overall transition to clean energy.
Great. So tell us more about how real estate owners and users will be accessing a renewable energy to a greater extent due to the new law.
Yeah, the access to renewable energy, I think, is really critical because, you know, you have access via on-site, on real estate buildings and footprints via, you know, solar and storage. And that provides local access and local use of renewable energy. And so what we're going to see is real estate owners taking advantage of this next 10 years through the expanded tax credits to be able to add these assets to their buildings, to their properties. So their tenants who are making these carbon commitments anywhere from, you know, the large corporates down to, you know, small mom and pop shops want to be able to have access to renewable energy, that they're going to be able to get access to that via on-site renewables. And then on the flip side of that is the off-site piece. And so what we've already seen, you know, over the past 5 to 10 years, just an explosion on the utility scale side of renewable energy, the wind and solar farms that are out in, nowhere, Texas or, in Iowa or California, all throughout the United States in different markets. Those big sources are far away from load generally, but it'll still allow corporates to enter into contracts that will essentially provide additionality. And what that means is, without the corporates being able to take that power via a contract to buy that power, those wind and solar farms wouldn't be built. So the additionality component that this bill will help bring to the market will really spur that investment and allow for users to be able to access renewable energy.
And one other thing I would say is there are some nuanced provisions in the act, such as transferability, mm-hmm. that also are really good things for investors and for some of the things that we see more commonly in public-private partnerships and, more nuanced arrangements with solar leasing projects and things like that. So that nuance is helpful for some contracting arrangements where you may have on or offsite projects and you're not necessarily directly the user of that power, but you're contributing to the grid, or you have a more widespread footprint in terms of the users versus investors, which is really good news for the sector overall.
The bill offers credits to utilities that produce nuclear energy, which many environmentalists don't believe is green energy. Did that surprise you, Mitch?
It wasn't necessarily surprising. And I think the reason why is when we look to our counterparts in the European Union, who are generally have been historically the leaders in the renewable energy front and the energy front in general, the European Commission reclassified nuclear as a green and sustainable energy source back in July of this year. So the fact that we see that within this bill is not necessarily surprising. And what I think it does is it recognizes the fact that this ongoing energy transition is going to be very complex and difficult to achieve, and that renewables are going to play a very big part of that, which are intermittent sources of energy, but that we still need some baseload generation, which nuclear can provide. And until sort of battery technology advances down both the cost curve and the duration curve, then that baseload energy generation will still play a role in the energy mix and the energy security and stability of our grid. So I think ultimately, no, it wasn't surprising, particularly given the EU's position earlier this year.
And I would just expand for those who aren't energy market experts out there, the terminology of baseload supply and intermittent energy. What that really means is electricity has to be instantaneously created and utilized. And so the beauty of fossil fuels has been a very predictable, steady supply of energy to our grid system, that whenever you go to turn on your light switch, you can, for the most part, expect that it's going to work because there's a coal-fired power generation plant somewhere, consistently mm-hmm. feeding that power to the grid. The thing with renewables, particularly, solar and wind, is that it only works when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. And so that's what we mean by intermittent. And so the point that Mitch is making about the energy transition is we are a high energy demand country. We have very high expectations about the reliability of power. And so you can't necessarily risk a overnight transition to renewable energy because we can't necessarily guarantee that same level of reliability. So there's always going to be a role for some kind of baseload power. And the beauty of nuclear is that, similar to coal or gas, it's always there churning, creating a reliable power source. And, while it may be a little complicated in terms of, where the environmentalists stand on it, for the most part, it does help to bring that, that reliable baseload into the overall mix. And then over time, as Mitch mentioned, as storage becomes cheaper and we see battery technology advancing, we won't necessarily have this problem where electricity has to be created and instantaneously utilized. We'll be able to store it and use it later on. I mean, I think we have seen fantastic leaps and bounds in that industry. Even, you know, in my short sort of 15 years, it's really, really advanced. And that's an exciting thing.
It's a longer transition than some people think it is, I guess.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So you can't have more electric vehicles on the road without more EV charging. And I think the burden of those chargers really does fall on the commercial real estate industry. How is real estate preparing for the growth in electric vehicles that the federal government is hoping for?
Great question. And glad that you raised it. I think there's a lot of misconception, I think, about the concept of electrification overall, and then what is really necessary from a charging standpoint, I don't think is very well understood. We definitely have seen major advancements in electric vehicle manufacturing, and it's really exciting to see how, you know, even the oldest of auto manufacturers have really gotten on board. And there, you really can't even pick an OEM these days that you can't point to a single one that doesn't have some kind of, you know, EV option in its portfolio. So I think that's really good news. But as we see the transition to more and more electric vehicles, suddenly you have a lot of cars on the road or trucks that aren't using gas, need to charge up their battery and don't have as many places to do it, right? We have a very vast network of gas stations around the country that's been established for, you know, 100 years, right? So how do we think about the placement of charging infrastructure in a thoughtful way that allows, you know, users to have that security and not have range anxiety, and to purchase an electric vehicle and have confidence that when they need to charge up, there's going to be a place to do it. I think we're kind of starting to come over the, you know, what do they call it? The chasm of technology adoption, where people are getting more and more comfortable with the idea. And the federal government has played a significant role in that, right? There was $7.5 billion in electric vehicle funding that came out of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs mm-hmm. Act, and now another, you know, $1.7 billion in charging-related funding that's in IRA. So the federal government's really pushing money to solve this problem, which will be both a government-led, right, for public charging locations and a commercially driven approach. We've seen, you know, the companies who are in this space, like the EVgos and Electrify America and Ecotality, and even, you know, the proprietary systems like Tesla, really, really making a push. So I think, you know, even in your own communities, you probably see starting to see more and more chargers popping up because there's a market there for those companies, and especially the vertically integrated ones like Tesla and Rivian, who see the potential. But I mentioned also on the public side, you know, the role of the federal government, state entities, and even at the local level, they have an obligation to make sure that that infrastructure is available for public use. And we're seeing interesting investments being made where the real estate sector has a significant opportunity to take advantage of that investment, because for the most part, they're the ones who have assets that are strategically placed where the cars are going. So it may be that we see more and more gas stations transitioning to charging stations, but you probably will see a lot of creative approaches where quick stops, convenience stores, fast food chains, big box retailers, really anybody who's in kind of dense areas or along highways or other transportation routes are playing a role in facilitating that charging infrastructure. So good news for the real estate sector. But I think there still is a challenge in the business model. And, you know, one of the things that isn't often talked about is how do you pay for that charging infrastructure, and how do we pass that cost on to consumers? And because the electricity, you know, sector is regulated a little bit differently, we're still having some, I think, pockets of challenge in terms of, can you charge by the kilowatt hour? We can't do that in all states right now, but that's kind of on the forefront of change. So, you know, there's still some kinks to be worked out. But overall, I think as we figure out that business model and as that funding starts to flow into the sector, we'll see those challenges being addressed. Mm-hmm.
And finally, and we referred to this a little bit before, the law incentivizes investment in renewable energy technology and production. To what extent do you think the real estate industry can and will participate in those investment opportunities?
You know, I think a point that Josephine brought up, and I want to reiterate, because it's such a critical point to remember when it comes to real estate, is that, you know, 40% of global carbon dioxide emissions come from the real estate sector. And of these emissions, approximately 70% of them are produced by building operations, right? So the real estate industry plays a vital role in getting to where we want to go in terms of net zero in accordance to the, you know, with the Paris Accord. And so the investment that the real estate industry will have to make is substantial. And what the IRA bill does is help make those investments, it catalyzes them, it gives them the push that real estate asset owners need to be able to make. It gives them the ability to make those investments with a long-term viewpoint in mind, which I think is something that's important to remember in the real estate industry. It illustrates that the real estate industry has an opportunity to lead and fundamentally transform the built environment around sustainability and incorporating renewable energy assets at the initial design phase, as well as leveraging the technology to retrofit existing assets, which Josephine mentioned is a much more difficult of a process to do. And I'll sort of close with this comment is just, you know, I'm really encouraged by what I see, you know, at JLL working with my colleagues to drive successful and impactful sustainability and renewable energy outcomes for our clients in the real estate industry. I've really been impressed by how many clients really see this as a business imperative and how tightly connected it is to the long-term success of their core business, which is real estate. And so the marrying of sustainability, renewable energy, and real estate is becoming just so tightly wound that the investment is going to follow, and things like the IRA bill really catalyzes that and spurs that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Josephine and Mitch. This was fabulous.
Thanks a lot for having us, Therese. Great conversation, and really happy that we were able to be here today.
Yes, thank you so much, Therese. It's been a pleasure.
All right, thank you both. Bye-bye. CPE will keep you abreast of the programs and investments that emanate from the IRA. Thanks for joining me on Sustainability Street. If you have any questions about this episode or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to me at therese.fitzgerald@cpe-mhn.com. Bye for now.